program entitled Reasons to Believe. Believe in God, believe in Jesus as Messiah, God and man, and to believe in the Catholic Church. Another name for our program is Catholic Apologetics or Fundamental Theology. And we're trying to base this on what Peter himself said in his third chapter, 15-16, always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and reverence. My wonderful guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and world and American history at John Paul II Catholic High, and I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church in 19th and Poplar here in Terre Haute. Ron, welcome once again, and we've come in our faith and reason section about doubt and difficulty, and that there really is a big difference, although sometimes we don't realize, fortunately, that there is a big difference. We have said that it's a sin to doubt the teachings of our faith once we've come to a knowledge that we really believe and given that gift. But difficulties are something entirely different with our faith. We'll always have some difficulties with our faith. Could you tell us the distinction?
Well, the church has always distinguished between the two, doubt and difficulty. Father Thomas Dubay, whom we've quoted on several occasions during this series, he defines doubt, quote, as a state of mind in which a person suspends judgment, the word suspends here is important, suspends judgment as to whether something is so or not, end of quote. For example, he says that one doubts that A is B when one, upon reflection, he or she decides neither to affirm nor to deny it. He says that some doubts are positive, that is, they are based on both pro and con reasons. Other doubts are merely negative, that is, there's no reason for either affirming or denying something. But he says a negative doubt is something closely related to ignorance. But essentially, what I want to leave with everyone is that doubt involves refusing to accept something as true when the evidence is conclusive.
Okay.
when it's reasonable to believe something. That's when you have what we would call a doubt.
Okay, when I've been raised a Catholic, I've been taught all about John 6, what Jesus said in the Gospel of St. John, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. I've always believed this, and then I get into college, and I don't want to go to Mass anymore, and I don't want to live a lifestyle contrary to the Church. So I'm saying I doubt the truth of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. We would say that could easily be personal fault or personal sin on the part of the person.
And of course, that's unreasonable. I mean, the person probably still believes it's true. For whatever reason, it's a difficulty for them, and so they either ignore it or sometimes even come to convince themselves that it isn't true anymore.
Well, and even sometimes, unfortunately, talk against it.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's say, what is a difficulty? And quote Newman's famous saying again, you've used it many times,
yes.
But I think it's a beautiful saying.
Let me repeat real quickly what the doubt is so we can contrast it with the difficulty. The doubt, again, is refusing to accept something as true that the evidence is conclusive, or at least it's certainly very reasonable to believe this is true. And this can be a sin. It depends on, you know, only God knows. And
how I got there.
Right. Now, on the other hand, a difficulty, people commonly confuse doubts and difficulties. They think they're the same thing, but they're not. Father Dubay defines difficulty, quote, as a problem, a not seeing how two realities fit together, end of quote. He remarks that, in a way, everything in the visible universe is surrounded with difficulties, with problems, with mystery. although we see a lot of truth, but there's also a lot that we don't see in just about almost everything. And he says that a difficulty is simply a situation we do not yet understand, or perhaps never will understand, the complete explanation. It's a difficulty is a limitation on our knowledge, which can be either a passing or it can be a permanent a limitation.
Okay, and wouldn't you say that all of us have difficulties with our faith, reconciling one thing against another? I think you're going to go into some practical examples. How do we reconcile a loving God with the existence of hell, for instance?
Or evil in the world.
Evil with a good God.
Right.
Suffering with a good God.
Yeah, suffering.
Those are some of the real problems that have been question marks all through history.
Well, a lot of people have lost their faith over such issues over the centuries. Lots of people have.
Okay. Well, but difficulties don't necessarily create a doubt.
No. Father DeBay tells us that the problem is that many of us assume that difficulties necessarily create doubts. But this need not be so. He tells us that a doubt is a suspension of judgment. I don't know whether A equals B.
I don't know if Christ is an
Right. Anchorist
or not.
And the problem is, it becomes sinful if you have sufficient information that it's true and then don't accept it. Again, only God knows, how guilty you are. But
I want to get elected to an office, and I'm going to give up my belief in the Eucharist or Catholic faith because I'm in a section where Catholicism is not accepted very well in the country. So I'm giving up what I know to be true, just for personal material reasons.
Or at least I'm not going to speak out on it and act on it.
Sure, or the same thing about abortion.
Sure.
I'm not going to speak against abortion, even though I personally believe that it is the killing of an unborn child.
Well, people rationalize that by saying, yeah, but I can get in there and do so much good. Mm-hmm. I'll never get there if I tell the truth, if I really tell what I believe. So, I'll just either not say anything about it at all, or address it, or try to skid around the issue, or compromise so I can get in there and do all that good. You know, the ends justify the means.
And, of course, I can even see a person saying, well, I'm not going to press it because I know it's such a problem, but if somebody asks me, I'm going to answer the truth. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Being silent is one thing, and telling a lie is another thing. Okay.
Well, Father DeBay goes on to say, a difficulty, on the other hand, can be concerned with a certain judgment and not in the least damage it. A difficulty exists if one has a certain judgment but doesn't see how they fit together. In other words, you believe it. I know this is true. I feel it in my heart. Even to a certain extent, I have reasons for believing this is true. But you don't. There's still a lot of unknown and mystery and what have you. And you don't see how it all fits together. But yet, I still believe this is true.
Okay.
And so that's a difficulty. To illustrate his point, he takes an example from physics. Even though light is a plain fact, physicists cannot reconcile its wave characteristics with its quanta or energy characteristics, he tells us. He says that they wisely don't deny either set of truths, even though they don't see how they could be fitted together.
Okay, now give me a couple examples. On a faith level, that's on a scientific level, things are hard to fit together.
Well, people frequently doubt things that they don't see how they fit together in matters of religion and morality. For example, he says that they don't see how hell is compatible with a good God.
And that's a tough one.
Sure it is. That's a difficulty, though.
Sure.
It's not a doubt. It does lead to doubt in some people's minds, but it need not necessarily do so at all. As he says, then some proceed to deny one of the other or both. And others don't see how God can be three separate persons possessing one nature. Or how Christ can be present in the Eucharist, in the Blessed Sacrament. So as a consequence, they doubt or deny the Trinity and the Blessed Sacrament because they don't understand it. They don't see it, so they just deny it. That's a case where, let's say, a difficulty does lead to a doubt. But what we're saying is it need not necessarily do so. In fact, it really shouldn't.
And there's a real difference.
Yes. And then he goes on to quote the famous John Henry Cardinal Newman in this regard, quote, 10,000 difficulties do not make one doubt. As I understand the subject, difficulty and doubt are incommensurate.
What does incommensurate mean?
Well, they're just not measurable.
They're not the same in any way. Okay. So that's a very famous quote, one of the most famous from the wonderful Cardinal Newman, who is up for canonization, one of the great converts to the church in over about a century or so ago.
Yeah, he joined the church in 1845. But he went on to live many years after that. He had been already a very prominent theologian, scripture scholar in the Anglican Church.
Okay.
And one of the leaders, of course, of the so-called Oxford movement, where there was a strong move within the Church of England, the High Church of England, those who were closest to the Catholic Church in doctrine and in liturgy and ceremony, things of that sort. He was trying to get the Anglican Church closer to Catholic doctrine. They were already pretty close in liturgy and things of that sort.
And particularly by studying the early writings of the Church Fathers.
He went on to live many years after he became a Catholic. In fact, I don't think he died until 1890, if I recall right. And he was 90 years old when he died.
Mm.
In fact, Pope Pius the... Leo the 13th made him a cardinal.
Oh, okay.
Because of his contributions to theology.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, Leo 13th, one of the great popes.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorites.
Okay. Well, what does the Catechism tell us about doubt rather than difficulty?
Well, the Catechism tells us that doubt can be a sin against faith. Not necessarily, but it can be. In this regard, it says, quote, the first commandment requires us to nourish and protect our faith with prudence and vigilance, and to reject everything that is opposed to it, end of quote. Then the Catechism says that there are various ways of sinning against faith. And it mentions voluntary doubt. Voluntary doubt about the faith disregards or refuses to hold as true what God has revealed and the Church proposes for belief. And then it talks about involuntary doubt. Refers to hesitation in believing, difficulty in overcoming objections connected with the faith, or also anxiety aroused by its obscurity. Now here's the key word, or the key sentence. If deliberately cultivated, doubt can lead to spiritual blindness.
Okay.
So deliberately cultivated, it can lead to spiritual blindness.
That's
voluntary doubt.
Yeah. So, again, we're kind of back to Newman's big distinction. 10,000 difficulties do not make one doubt. And I think that's one of the clearest distinctions that we've got. Okay.
Well, when you say the creed, we say the creed every Sunday. Goodness, that's full of difficulties. Because it's a mystery.
Sure.
And on various series that we've had, we've tried to explain, for example, the Nicene Creed, we had a series on that. We've tried to explain up to a point what the Church understands about these things from an intellectual, an academic, theological, philosophical point of view. But then, beyond that, there's still that great realm of mystery that we just simply have to accept it on faith.
I always liked that story about St. Augustine, who was walking along the seashore trying to, with his magnificent mind, discern deeper the mystery of the Trinity, the three persons in one God. And he saw the little boy digging in the sand, and he put his bucket into the waves and then pour the water into the hole he was digging, dig some more, pour the water in. And Augustine stopped and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Sir, I'm putting the ocean into this hole I'm digging." And Augustine said, "Well, look out there, that endless ocean, even beyond where you can't see, beyond the horizon, there's still more water. You really can't put the ocean into that little hole in the sand." And the little boy stuck his shovel in the ground, and he said, "And neither Augustine Can you put the ocean of God's infinity and mystery into the small thimble of your mind and then supposedly disappeared having been an angel? It's a nice legendary story.
Right.
But it makes the point that when we're dealing with God, as the psalmist always says, "Oh Lord, our Lord, how wonderful is your name in all the earth." It's awe and wonder.
You mentioned the great St. Teresa of Avila, great 16th century saint that you mentioned in the session before. She was, you know, a very holy person, and she had a great deal of respect for learning. She wasn't a scholar, of course, but she did study and read some of the theologians and had good theologian priests explain things to her.
And a brilliant mind.
And a brilliant mind. But she was also extremely close to God and in union with God and a very, very holy, virtuous person. On one occasion, God favored her with a vision or some kind of inspiration where she understood. She'd been meditating on the Trinity, apparently, and where she understood probably more deeply than any other human being has ever understood. She must have said something to somebody. She's very humble, so she was very careful about what she said. So they said, "Well, like, tell us all about it," you know. And it was ineffable there. I mean, there weren't any words that she could use that would describe this great mystery that she had been so privileged to get a deeper understanding, far more so than that only we'll have, and you know, when we see God face to face.
And even when we see God face to face, there will still be unlimited knowledge to examine. All right, could we talk about now the logical reasons for believing that God exists? We've been talking about faith. Now we're talking about reason again. Can just from reason alone, this wonderful light that God gives us, can we come to a knowledge of the existence of a supreme being, or whom we call God?
Well, what we've done, of course, is come to a whole new plateau, so to speak, in our series, where we finished basically looking at faith and reason and using those to try to develop certainty, which of course ultimately comes from God and the infusion of His grace and the theological virtue, of course, of divine faith. And as you said, now we're going to start taking a look, though, at using reason, trying to prove, or at least making it reasonable to believe that God exists. Because all apologetics courses has to start with that. Because if He doesn't, then everything else doesn't matter.
Fundamental question.
Right. And of course, obviously, if somebody already believes these things very deeply, for however reason,
sure,
they wouldn't necessarily need this kind of discussion we're having here, except maybe to help explain it to other people who don't understand it.
Sure.
So certainly it has value in that sense, even if they themselves already have a very deep faith.
So it's always a part of Catholic apologetics or fundamental theology.
And we briefly discussed or touched on this subject when we discussed St. Anselm in another earlier sessions. And I said any course of apologetics begins with proving that God exists. Because, as I said, all other doctrines, they matter only if He does exist. And we hope to prove, or at least make it reasonable to believe, that God does exist during the next half a dozen sessions or so, where we'll take a look at some of these proofs that have been given by theologians over the last couple thousand years to prove God's existence. And also something about the qualities that He possesses, known as His attributes or perfections. And we can do this by simply observing the universe that we live in, God's creation, and reasoning to His existence.
Okay.
Philosophers and theologians have developed several arguments over the centuries using this line of reasoning. And many of these arguments are as sound as, I think, any mathematical formula. St. Thomas Aquinas, who was a Dominican priest, theologian, and philosopher, lived in the 13th century, proposed five arguments to prove God's existence. You might recall that when we were talking about St. Anselm, we only mentioned that much of his theology, the books he wrote, the Proslogion and the Monologion and various other books, was just to do just that, to prove God's existence.
From reason.
And Thomas Aquinas called the Doctor Angelicus, that is the angelic doctor. He's considered one of the greatest theologians and philosophers who ever lived. Two of his most famous works, the Summa Theologica and the Summa Contra Gentiles, are the finest examples of his work on Christian philosophy and theology. And he believed that human beings could reason from an observation of God's creation or nature to proof of his existence. And to achieve this, he developed five ways or arguments. Essentially, his arguments are broken down into two different ones. There's the argument from the intelligent design, and the second group is the other four arguments, the arguments from causation. Now, we're not going to go into those. And the main reason we're not going to go into them, to do a very thorough job would take almost a whole series itself. Another reason we're not going to into it, and probably the main reason we're not going to go into it, is because these reasons are really not used very much by the church anymore.
Still valid.
They're still valid. They're very valid. But it's a part of this scholastic theology and philosophy, which was so dominant in the church from about the 12th, 13th century on, up until Vatican Council II. It had its ups and downs. We mentioned Pope Leo XIII a while ago. He gave a real stimulus to...
studies of St. Thomas.
Yes, the studies of St. Thomas, what I think was called neo-scholasticism. And there was a resurgence of it there for a number of years. But beginning in about the probably the 40s or the 50s, within the Catholic Church now, there was a real, I won't say a rejection of it, but there was a sort of a setting it aside and the beginning to develop a much more experiential approach. We're going to describe.
Well, say something, Ron, about, because St. Thomas used it to perfection, the syllogism, a way of reasoning to a divine revelation or the relation between truths and the like. But as you were saying, something, this became sort of blighted out or fell into disuetude or disuse. And how did that kind of happen?
Well, I won't explain what a syllogism is, so you know people will just have to accept that there is such a thing.
And okay, it's a way of reasoning.
In fact, we have a course at John Paul II Catholic High where we go into different kinds of syllogisms and use them in this, that, and the other, of course, in logic.
It's part of logic,
yeah.
How to think clearly.
Right. It was a major analytical tool used by theologians for centuries to better understand the Catholic faith, that is, the doctrines of the Church. And the method has been identified with scholasticism, that is, the philosophical and theological systems, of which St. Thomas Aquinas was the most prominent practitioner. This method of trying to understand revealed truth more deeply has always had its critics, though, in the Church. Even during the times of Thomas, it had its critics. But it came under attack, especially in the first half of the 20th century. And since Vatican Council II, it has almost ceased being a theological tool. The method was considered too rational, too logical, okay, too intellectual, and not experiential enough for the modern mind. And by experiential, I mean a method that stresses the importance of human experience. Too much of a thing of the mind, too abstract.
Too abstract.
Right.
Cut off from life.
And if we had time to go into it, I think our audience would see, listening audience would see what we mean, of course, by abstract. Again, that doesn't mean that it's not valid. It just means that some theologians think it's too much out of touch with reality, with human experience. In theology, this means the human experiences as found in the Bible, tradition, and the writings of the Church Fathers. Advocates of this experiential methodologies also stress the employment of modern philosophical methods to theological questions. And certain French theologians of the 1940s and 1950s call this return to the original sources of Catholic doctrine, that is the Church Fathers, the Bible, things like that, in French, the ressourcement.
It was kind of a whole new movement to
yes.
approach existence of God from more experience of human beings.
Yeah, this is part of the Nouvelle Theology, the new theology.
Okay.
And both Pope John Paul II practiced and Pope Benedict XVI practices experiential methods in theology. Nonetheless, the scholastic methodology, including the use of the syllogism, has served, I think, the Church well over the centuries, and I understand is making somewhat of a comeback in certain theological circles. As I said, we're not really going to go into Thomas's five ways, because that would require looking at the method of explaining what the syllogism is and actually using the syllogism and trying to prove God's existence of using these intelligent design arguments and then also into his causation arguments. Essentially, the intelligent design argument is that you look at the universe and it's so complex and it's so all this and that and the other that it simply had to be designed. It had to be set in motion and created by an intelligent designer, a supernatural intelligent designer.
If there is a watch, there has to be a watchmaker. Yes. Don't miss, because our time is running out on us, on the bottom of page 49 there, that wonderful example you have that sort of illustrates backwards why there has to be a designer on the bottom of page 49, that bottom paragraph.
Oh, yes. Well, we're talking there about scientists and philosophers who argue that everything that exists, including the universe, is simply a result of pure chance rather than design and that kind of thing. And they usually rely on some evolutionary hypothesis to account for what exists in living or non-living forms. And scientists who deny God's existence, or at least they deny that he designed and created the universe, must rely on some explanation that involves chance. Perhaps you have heard the story that if a monkey threw millions of letters up and let them fall millions of times, that eventually, by chance, Shakespeare's Hamlet would fall into place.
Okay.
And I've also heard the absurd story that if a tornado went through a junkyard enough times, it eventually would reassemble the pieces in the junkyard into a 747 jet airplane. And there are a lot of other similar type stories of that aside. But to avoid giving credit for anything, which is usually the most reasonable explanation for the cause of something, giving God credit, that is, the unbeliever posits absolutely absurd alternative explanations. In other words, one has to work very hard to be an atheist. You have to work at it real hard.
Okay. I heard a joke recently about an atheist who was being buried, and his friends came and knew that he didn't believe in God or anything, and he said, "There he is, all dressed up and no place to go." Well, just an aside, but let's conclude with the human brain is the most complex thing in the universe, and you were saying it's even comparable to a computer, and obviously computers have intelligence, human intelligence behind them, and if there's much more design and complexity in the world, then certainly there's got to be supreme intelligence behind the world itself. Isn't that the point?
Yeah, computers don't spring out, into existence. They don't evolve by chance. They're designed by and manufactured by human intelligence. And I think how much more true is this of the universe? The design and creation of the universe would require a super intelligence and power.
Okay, I like your examples. Our time is beginning once again to run out. We're getting the red flag from our timekeeper. So thanks to all who have been with us. Hope you'll be with us again. May God bless you always and in all ways.